Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Any minute now, the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to announce whether it will uphold subpoenas for some of Donald Trump's financial records, tax returns, and other records from before he was president. Those subpoenas, as many of you know, issued by Congress in conjunction with updating conflict of interest laws and by the Manhattan grand jury in connection with a criminal investigation. Now, as soon as we have a ruling, we will bring it to you. And then later in the program, our legal analyst and All Things Considered host, Jamie Floyd, and Trump Inc. co-host, Andrea Bernstein, will join us with a close look at what it means once they get a chance to read into the decision. Trump, you know, is the first president in about 40 years to refuse to release his tax returns to the public voluntarily. So people are wondering what he's hiding. And remember, it did get to the point of that criminal investigation by the Manhattan DA, that grand jury in Manhattan under the DA's supervision, into the hush money paid to Stormy Daniels that already sent Trump's lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, to prison. Cohen said Trump directed him to make those payments. Trump is also suspected there of having lied to a bank about his wealth to help him get a loan. But will the court force the records into the public while Trump is in the White House? That's the question. We should find out from John Roberts and Company any minute. Now, in the 2016 presidential election, Zerlina Maxwell was the director of progressive media for the Hillary Clinton campaign. And she emerged from that experience with a question that has led to a new book. And listen carefully to the title, The End of White Politics, How to Heal Our Liberal Divide. It's not how to heal our left-right divide, it's how to heal our liberal divide. Because Zerlina Maxwell's experience made her confront not just right-wing white identity politics, but also what she sees as progressive white identity politics, even if many white progressives might deny there is such a thing or not be able to see it. So let's see what Zerlina Maxwell, now an MSNBC political analyst, sees and has in mind. Thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
And if the Trump tax returns ruling comes out while we're talking, you'll get the first reaction.
Yes, well, I'm really excited to see this decision.
What's the liberal divide? Why do you use that term?
Well, I think that after 2016, there was a lot of analysis that said that Hillary Clinton was defeated by Donald Trump in the Electoral College because she played identity politics. And it was framed as, you know, identity politics is a bad thing, and that's why she wasn't able to win over the white working class voters in the Midwest that cost her the three states that led to her defeat. And my premise is that everything we've been doing all along is identity politics on the left and on the right, because America was founded with a central focus on whiteness in culture, in politics, and in everything in between. And so I feel like, you know, Donald Trump successfully exploited white identity and used white identity grievance politics to excite a certain section of the American electorate that has been anxious as the country goes through demographic shift towards a place by 2045 when white voters will be a minority for the first time ever. And so what I'm trying to say in the book is that on the left, we have to recognize what's happening around us, and we have to change our messaging and our focus and our investments, most importantly, and make sure that we're putting people in positions of power, on campaigns, in legislative halls, in Congress, who reflect our base. And so our liberal divide is the failure to understand that we also have our own blind spots. We also struggle with white privilege and white resentment, and we have to confront that on our side and acknowledge it in order to move forward. Republicans absolutely are already understanding the demographic shift. That's why they tried to suppress the vote. That's why they tried to gut the Voting Rights Act. This is all with their understanding of the demographics. And my argument is that we on the left have to understand this too and move forward using that understanding to create coalition, multiracial coalitions.
So, for example, you write about an experience where you got booed at a liberal political conference in 2018 because of your association with the Clinton campaign. Can you describe what happened there and why you came to see it in white identity terms rather than democratic socialists, you know, versus the more centrist politics of Secretary Clinton?
Of course. Well, I see it this way. I agree with most of the policy positions of, you know, a Senator Bernie Sanders or a Democratic Socialist. I support Medicare for all. My position in working for Hillary Clinton was seeing the existential threat that Donald Trump posed to the lives and safety of not only people who look like me, but everybody else as well. I mean, we're in pandemic and in quarantine, so I think I can say that I had that one. I was on the nose in terms of the threat that it posed, and particularly to communities of color because of the overt racism and bigotry. You know, that's not just rhetoric. That becomes a real life threat and harm in people's lives. And so I didn't see it as a divide on the left end of the spectrum, because in the conference, and it's a bipartisan conference, but most of the audience, I would say, was made up of Bernie Sanders supporters. There were some MAGA folks in the crowd, too, just because they wanted to sort of see liberals fight it out over 2016. But in the conference, I was making the explicit point that black women and women of color collectively are the heart and soul of the Democratic base, and we are the moral compass, and that we win elections at every level. I mean, all of the data supports this. And if you look at even the most recent elections or even unconventional wins like Doug Jones in Alabama, black women have been organizing and getting out the vote of entire households, communities, and church views. And yet Democrats often focus on white working class men and white working class voters. And what do we need to do to get back those white working class voters? And I am like, we're over here. That 77,000, which we're assuming probably wrongly, are all one type of person in the three states that cost us the Electoral College, is a much smaller number than the 1 million black people that did not turn out in 2016, that had showed up in 2012 and in 2008 in those same three states. Right. And to say that we have to focus on Midwestern voters, which to me is really just code for white, and it obscures the fact that millions of black people live in Detroit and in Milwaukee, and we need to be talking directly to those folks and to their issues and go where they are. And, you know, I think it was a moment where, you know, I said literally, you know, I don't think booing a black woman is a good strategy politically because the future looks like me. You know, the squad, AOC, Ayanna Pressley, Rashida Tlaib, and Ilhan Omar, who elected in 2018, they represent the future of the progressive movement in terms of what we will see in positions of power and authority in the future. And I think that we need to learn how to engage with people who are not white and learn how to, you know, it was almost like learn how to talk to us, because talking at us and yelling at us and harassing us online, it's not a winning strategy in the long term.
And you have a great Ayanna Pressley quote that the people who feel the most pain need to be the closest to power. In seeking to maximize turnout for this November, then, how well, in your opinion, is the Joe Biden campaign learning the lessons that you just described from 2016 and applying them?
Well, fortunately for Joe Biden, this is an unconventional race where you have an opportunity to use so many unconventional strategies. You know, I saw that the Biden campaign is doing a voter registration effort with influencers online with a bunch of DJs, you know, D-Nice, who had Club Quarantine go viral early on in the quarantine period. And I think it's more creative things and strategies like this that will help Joe Biden actually speak to the audiences that he needs to be engaged. Because you know, you can no longer assume who your audience is. I think when we saw, you know, Generation Z collectively, you know, troll the president's rally on TikTok, that was a signal that Generation Z is engaged in this political conversation. They know what's going on. They have enough know-how to you know, do an online action and then delete it to erase their tracks. And so they need to be engaged where they are. So if that's gives the opportunity to the Joe Biden campaign to, you know, use unconventional influencers in social media spaces, as opposed to the traditional Democratic model of turning out the black vote, which is going to church every Sunday, a bunch of church services every Sunday. That is going to be a signal that they have learned some of the lessons of 2016. Now, I think Hillary Clinton doesn't get enough credit for the work that she did do in hiring black staff, which was a very important element in terms of creating and crafting the message for those communities, hiring Latinx staff to target specific communities, being able to translate the website and all social media content into Spanish, which is a very difficult thing. It's very complicated because, as you know, not everybody speaks exactly the same way. And so you have to, you know, have multiple translations of the same message. And that's very important in a campaign in this particular moment when, you know, even more so than black voters and black women, the Latinx voting bloc is the largest growing, and AAPI right behind. And I think it's important as we head forward for the Biden campaign to focus on speaking directly to those communities. And if that means that you're on TikTok, then so be it. But you have to do it. And anything at this point is more presidential than what we're currently living through. And so this is your opportunity to be creative.
If you're just joining us, our guest is MSNBC political analyst and former Hillary Clinton campaign Progressive Media Director Zerlina Maxwell. Her new book is called The End of White Politics, How to Heal Our Liberal Divide. We can take phone calls for her at 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280 with your thoughts and questions. Do you have anybody in mind for Joe Biden's running mate, any particular person in the, you know, through the lens of everything you've been saying?
I don't have a particular person. I have been very explicit about the fact that I think he should pick a black woman. He has an embarrassment of riches, so to speak, because you have a number of qualified black women on the list that are being considered and vetted to be his running mate. And I think they all bring, you know, a unique set of experiences to the job. And the reason why I've been explicit about his need to pick a black woman specifically is, one, I think it would signal that he understands the moment. He said he wants to be a transitional figure to, you know, the next phase of the progressive era. And I think, you know, to my point in the book, I think that's great. But I think that he needs this also signal that he knows what that era is going to look like and who will get us there. And I think by picking a black woman, it's not about, you know, the diversity and inclusion of having a pretty photo to say, look at the diversity in the photo. The State of the Union photo will be excellent, and everybody will you know, frame that for history. But the perspective of that black woman, the lived experience of that black woman, her view on policy and her understanding of how policy impacts outcomes, and it's not the same for everyone, and that there are systemic changes needed because you've lived through it, and you know what it's like to live in America as a black woman in this body. And that then will inform how you govern the country and how you advise the president on issues that impact those communities. But also, I think the uniqueness of having a black woman is, I honestly believe, and, you know, to quote one of my colleagues on the Clinton campaign, a senior Democratic strategist and senior advisor on the Clinton campaign, Mignon Moore, she always says, and told us this and taught us this during the campaign in 2016, black women are the moral compass. And we often will advocate really for our own selves and survival. And by doing so, because often we are on the margins, we uplift everyone. And that's why we take the entire church pew and the whole community to go vote all at once, because we understand that fundamentally voting is an essential part of our own freedom and liberation in this country. And I think that having a Black woman by your side as we handle COVID-19, which is impacting Black and brown communities at higher rates than others, you will have that moral compass in the White House as you govern this nation through, hopefully, and out of this nightmare that we're currently situated in. And I think that would be a critical component to not only success at the ballot box, but success governing the nation if he's elected president.
Here's some pushback, I think, from Kevin in the Bronx. Kevin, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Brian. First of all, I appreciate your guest's interest in... I voted for Hillary. I supported Hillary. I believe that she just was the wrong candidate. It's a bad candidate. And it's more than... And we needed to bring in the flyover states and the white middle class that was being excluded. That was number one. Number two, though, I think Joe did himself a big disservice. And I was for Joe from the very beginning. I wanted Joe to run in 2016. I think he did himself a big disservice, painting himself in a corner by insisting he's going to have a female candidate. And in other words, I'm not picking a candidate because of race, creed, color, or gender. It's about mindset, it's about ideology. And quite frankly, I don't think any of the female candidates who he's thinking about are going to be able to bridge the divide, who's going to be good for the ticket. It's about winning.
Any
it's not
of them,
about
Kevin?
All this other ideology.
Why not? None
well,
of
I'll
the...
tell you why. It's about, I'll tell you why. Who's going to help bring in a big southern state? Who's going to help bring in a big flyover state? Who's going to help bring in multiple ones? Who's got the wherewithal to negotiate and work with people across the aisle to help pass legislation?
And Kevin, I'm going to leave it there and get a response. So
yeah.
There's what you
sure,
hear
I,
from
well,
some corners of the party,
yeah.
Serlina.
Yes, of course. And I have an answer. So the first name that comes to mind on the specific question of who can work across the aisle, who can bring in those voters that Kevin is talking about. Well, Stacey Abrams did that in Georgia. She not only worked across the aisle as a part of the state legislature in the state of Georgia, which is a southern state. She tripled Latino turnout. She tripled AAPI turnout. And she also received rural white votes as a part of the coalition. And obviously, she had Black women organizing and getting out the vote for her in Georgia. And as we know, that race was not so fair. And so, you know, she is one person who could bridge that divide. I think that when we... one of the things I have to point out, very important, and is actually a critical aspect of my book, because I talk about the media and I talk about how we default or we talk about whiteness, but we talk about it in other ways, and we need to identify the ways in which we do that. So, you know, on election night, when people, analysts like myself, but who may not be aware of this, will use a phrase like suburban woman voter. They mean white woman. When they use the term flyover state, they mean white people in the Midwest. When they're talking about those white working class voters, they often mean white. And that obscures the fact that the majority of working class voters and minimum wage workers in this nation are women of color. When we went into this pandemic and COVID-19, one of the major stories was the fact that women of color were the hardest impacted because they are the majority of these first line and front line workers in the nursing fields and in the home aid fields, domestic workers and grocery store employees. And so I think it's important to the point about how are we going to win those flyover states, that we also acknowledge that Black people live in those flyover states, and more Black people live in many of these places than the white working class voters that gave Donald Trump the election in 2016. And that is the entire point of my book. The way to bridge this divide is to acknowledge that there are more Black people that stayed home in 2016 and didn't, you know, choose Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton. They chose the couch. You know, to quote Bakari Sellers, he says they chose the couch over voting. And in addition, 200,000 Black voters were suppressed in Wisconsin alone. And so it's important to understand that, you know, if we are going to be honest about the makeup and the coalition that we is going to win and it is necessary to win, that that includes black voters in those flyover states. It includes black voters who are working class. It includes Latinx voters who are working class. And so I just wanted to be clear about the fact that I'm not ignoring those flyover states. I'm saying that what we're doing wrong is that we're ignoring the black and brown voters who live in those flyover states. And we can't continue to do that and be successful.
Because there are more of them who stayed home than white voters who crossed over after voting for Obama to vote for Donald Trump. My guest is Zerlina Maxwell. Her new book is The End of White Politics, How to Heal Our Liberal Divide. Okay, Zerlina, you ready for the breaking Supreme Court news?
I am ready.
President Trump's financial records and tax returns must be revealed to several Democratic-led House committees and New York State prosecutors. The court ruled 7-2 with only Thomas and Alito dissenting. Wow.
I love hearing breaking news on the radio. That was great. I didn't even look at my phone or anything. That was very dramatic. And I was like holding my breath a little. I am relieved to hear that. The rule of law is still intact, thank God, in some way, right? I think this is, as a progressive who believes in the rule of law, I've never practiced law, but I did get a degree in law from Rutgers Law School. And so, you know, I truly believe in the rule of law. And I believe that the president, in an unprecedented way, had been hiding these records. And it doesn't appear that the argument that they made to keep them hidden works even for the very partisan Supreme Court. And that is good to see. It's not surprising that Justice Alito and Thomas are the dissenters. That's not surprising to me either. But I think that this is a good day for the rule of law in America.
And I only have this top line from SCOTUS blog, but looking at the one line, it looks like it's a definitive ruling on what could have been a more equivocal ruling. Like they could have said, this has to go back to the lower courts for certain various kinds of reconsideration. But from the way this is worded, it looks like they just simply ordered Trump the Mazars firm that does his tax returns and Deutsche Bank to release the records, to just release the records that Congress was seeking and the Manhattan DA is seeking. Again, we'll get a closer read as more lines from this come out, and listeners later in the program, after they've had a chance to read it, our legal analyst, Jamie Floyd, who, of course, is also our All Things Considered host, and our Trump Inc. co-host, Andrea Bernstein, who specializes in looking at the intersection between Trump's business interests and the national interest. So this is obviously about that as well. They will come on later in the program and give us a closer read as to what this is really going to mean. We get a look at. But on the politics, Zerlina, with just Thomas and Alito dissenting, it means that both of Trump's picks for the Supreme Court, both of his justices, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, voted against them.
That is going to make him very upset. I am anxiously awaiting the tweet. I think there was a presidential harassment all caps tweet earlier this morning. So I think that he has been feeling a little bit under the stress of it. And I think that there were often times where the cases of and news stories about the financial records and, you know, as the court cases moved through, there were a number of times where his behavior would become more erratic and it wouldn't be clear until a couple of weeks later that it was related to some sort of ruling as this case moved through. And so I'm bracing myself a bit, actually, because, you know, I think we have this pandemic going on as the president is, you know, very stressed out about this specific thing. If he wasn't concerned about the contents of these tax returns and financial records, he would have released them a long time ago, because I don't think that, you know, it's necessarily, you know, a political benefit to him to seem to be hiding things, although Trump is a very unconventional political figure where the rules don't necessarily apply the same. But I do think that, you know, there's going to be a lot in here. We already do know a lot about his financial history because of the New York Times report that didn't get enough attention at the time. And also we know some new information from Mary Trump's book that just came out as well. So This is going to be a close story to keep an eye on as we, you know, are living through a pandemic where the federal response appears to be, at this moment, you're on your own. And that's a very scary thing as well in the backdrop of all of this.
I may need to clarify and correct part of what I said about that breaking story. As I'm looking a little more closely here, it looks like so far that 7-2 ruling only applies to the New York District Attorney case. that's still huge because they're seeking, you know, tax records that could prove financial fraud on the part of Donald Trump. So that's the 7-2 ruling. And it looks now like we're still waiting for the one pertaining to the House of Representatives subpoena. So we'll wait for that. But even with just the Manhattan DA, this is a grand jury doing a criminal investigation. And The court has apparently ruled 7-2 that those records would have to be turned over. And it's really about whether the president is held to the same standard under the rule of law as every other American. Because I think his central argument there was that because he's the president, they can't look at this, even though the potential crimes that they're looking into took place before he was president.
Right.
So it would be a victory for the rule of law on that score. Okay, so we will wait for more details on that. We will give them to you as they come in. We have a few minutes left with Zerlina Maxwell, who was the progressive media director for the Hillary Clinton 2016 campaign and is an MSNBC political analyst these days and author of a new book called The End of White Politics, How to Heal Our Liberal Divide, the heart of which, as she's been explaining, and if you're just joining us, is that the Biden campaign and the Democratic Party generally, in order to grow, should stop obsessing on white voters who defected to Donald Trump and look more at voters of color who stayed home in 2016 and who otherwise have not been sufficiently served to turn out sufficiently served by the Democratic Party. And let's take another phone call. Desiree in Brooklyn. Desiree, thank you so much for calling. You're on WNYC.
Hi. So your screener, I am a black woman. I don't believe that black women are the moral authority of the Democratic movement. I'm 52. I was born here but raised in the South. And my perspective is this. Given the current climate that we are in, nobody should have to tell you why you need to go to the polls. Everything that is happening to our lives should be the reason why you get your butt up, you register to vote, and you go vote. There's no special words that Joe Biden has or could say that needs to convince you to go do what is your civic duty to do, but not just your civic duty to do, your moral duty to do as a person who is oppressed in this country. And I'm also going to say this. When you say people of color, what you really mean is black people, and that's fine. It's okay if your focus is on black people because that is your community. But don't say people of color when you mean black people. Don't say black and brown people when you mean black people because the issues are not the same. We're not, you know, the board. We're not a hive mind. We don't all have the same perspective. And one of the reasons why it is so difficult to garner the vote of people of color is because when we talk about people of color, we talk about only the issues that we experience, which means the people on reservations, their issues are not getting discussed by us when we talk about people of color. So I just think it's really important to be very clear. Voting is your civic duty. If you live in this country and you are oppressed and someone has to convince you to vote, I'm judging you.
Zerlina?
Oh, I judge people who don't vote all the time. And thank you, Desiree. I appreciate your comments. I think back to my aunt, Janet, who is, in her 70s now, but in Selma, Alabama in 1965. She was 17. And she marched in Selma, and the night before, she hid from the Klan, who was out sort of, you know, roaming the streets. And so I agree with you that you should not be need to be convinced to vote. I think thinking about my Aunt Janet and her bravery, and also my grandfather who marched with her, you shouldn't need a reason. But you do, and people do, and people do need access, and they need voter education. And, you know, I do empathize and understand that some people feel that the system is rigged and that their vote doesn't matter. But I think that if our votes did not matter, and if the demographic and numbers were not in the on the side of people who are not white as we head into the future, that the Republican Party would not be trying to take away our votes. They would not be trying to appoint and confirm conservative judges on the federal bench to consolidate power as they become, and their voters traditionally become a smaller and smaller share of a winning coalition. So I agree with much of what you said. I don't know why you don't think black women are their moral compass, because the argument you just made was essentially, you know, a moral argument as to why voting is essential to freedom and liberation. And so I take your comments to heart, and I thank you for them.
Desiree, thank you very much. And I guess, you know, one other piece of that that comes to my mind is it's not enough, I think, historically, just in terms of human nature. If you're a member of an oppressed group, which is what Desiree cited, it's not enough necessarily that in and of itself to motivate people to the polls. You also have to think there's enough hope, there's enough representation of you mm-hmm. by the alternative to make it worth it. Is that a piece worth commenting on?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, there are a lot of people who agree with Desiree. You know, we're in a pandemic, we're in quarantine, you shouldn't need a reason, you know, to have to go and vote against the status quo. I get that argument. However, in reality, you do need to give people a reason. There are a lot of people who are like, I'm just going to stay home. I mean, it's terrible. What difference does it make? You know, a lot of folks in 2016 would say, well, I don't like either one of these candidates. And I would say, I don't always have to love the person I'm voting for. I mean, I would make a positive argument of why I thought Hillary Clinton would make a good president. But I think that, you know, when we say things like the lesser of two evils, when one side is not evil, literally not doing anything that is intentionally and actively harmful, we're just trying to defend the rights and freedoms of other people and, you know, push back against an administration that is separating children from their parents and putting them into cages. And I think that there's an easy, you know, that's an easy choice, but I think that people do need to be motivated to act. And a lot of people do feel powerless, and sometimes voting can seem like it's not enough. So why even try to do the small thing when it won't fix all of the problems? But everybody, I think if you look at the bigger picture, can understand that voting is necessary but not sufficient. In, you know, to use some law school terms mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. folks are familiar with. You know, and it's an essential aspect of being a citizen. And I do think that it is something that we all should do in every election. But I also think that we have to look beyond just voting. I think 2018 taught us, and 2016 certainly taught us, that, you know, if Donald Trump can be president, that if you are a competent, you know, prepared, educated leader in your community, that you should run for something in that community. One of my colleagues on the Clinton campaign, Amanda Littman, started Run for Something, and she has been drafting up and helping facilitate the campaigns of millennials who are now stepping up to run for office. And so I do believe that voting is a piece of it. And some people, you know, can feel disaffected by the process. And I get that. But there's also the ability to run for office yourself. And in addition, one of the things I say in the book is that more black and brown people, and when I'm saying black and brown, I mean black and brown, black and Latinx, AAPI. I mean, we can go down the list, but I think more people of all backgrounds should think about campaigns as a job, especially in this moment when, you know, internships have fallen through and you cannot go outside or go back to college, and you are wondering what you can do to help in your community. Well, politics and public service and campaigns are work that you can do, whether it's volunteering to start or actually getting a full job as a virtual organizer. You know, I think that civic engagement is important at this moment. And I think that's one way people can feel like they are doing more than just vote. Quickly, I'll tell you a story of my first weekend volunteering on the Obama campaign in 2008. It was before I moved and became a full-time field organizer in Virginia. I was in New Jersey, and the person in charge of the, you know, registering voters at this fair was 17. And I remember asking her rather naively at the time, "Why are you here? You can't vote." And she said to me very seriously and earnestly, I have to live in the country. And she was right about that. Also, she added, and this is the more important piece, she said, if I vote, that's one vote. But if I register 50 people or 100 people this afternoon to vote and they go and vote, that's 100 votes that I've added to the side that I agree with and I think will, you know, keep my family safe in the country that I'm living in, even though I can't vote. And so she taught me that everyone can get involved, whether you're 11 or 12 and you want to go you can't go outside, but virtually try to contribute in some way, shape, mm-hmm. or form, you know, you can do that. And so she taught me that everybody has a role to play, even beyond voting, if you don't think that that's enough.
And here's one more piece of depth into this Supreme Court ruling on Trump's tax returns for you to comment on, and then we'll be out of time and move on to some other guests. It is looking increasingly like a split decision and like there won't be an immediate turnover of Trump's tax returns in the New York criminal case, though it could come in a matter of weeks. Here's the AP's latest version as they continue to read into it. It says the Supreme Court kept a hold on President Trump's financial records that Congress has been seeking. The ruling on that part returns the case to the lower courts with no clear prospect for when the case might be ultimately resolved. Apparently they're going to let the lower courts rule on the question of separation of powers that underlies that part. But that decision came after the court upheld the Manhattan DA's demand for Trump's tax returns as part of a criminal investigation that includes hush money payments to women who claim they had affairs with Trump. Those records, well, it will be at least several weeks, the AP says, before the court issues a formal judgment that would trigger the turnover of the records. Because Trump is allowed to argue like any other citizen on other grounds in court to keep the records closed. But what the court did do was say that he doesn't have special privileges in this case because he's president of the United States. So if the court in the New York case rules that the record should be turned over like for any other person, then they will be turned over, but they have to go back and make that decision one way or another. So it's a little more equivocal than it looked like in the top line, but he lost his special privilege that he was claiming as president of the United States to be exempt from criminal prosecution by the New York grand jury. And the as far as Congress, that one's going to have to go back to the lower courts to resolve an issue. Last thought?
Well, this is going to be a very complicated ride as we head into the election. I think all of this in the backdrop of the pandemic, it's very serious, right? I mean, this is the rule of law. This is the access to the ballot. This is, you know, the governing, the government being responsible for the lives and safety of Americans. And I think that, you know, corruption is something that can rot the core of any democracy and democratic society. And so both of these things are connected. And so it's very important for everyone to pay attention to these cases as they go through and hopefully become resolved before the election, right, which is still right ahead. And so in some ways, these past couple of weeks have felt like, you know, we're the Titanic headed for the iceberg and there's no captain on the ship. And so, you know, that can feel destabilizing and we're bracing for impact. But, you know, we do have the ability in a democratic society to steer the ship ourselves, too.
Zerlina Maxwell, MSNBC political analyst, Clinton campaign in 2016, progressive media director and author of the new book, The End of White Politics, How to Heal Our Liberal Divide. Thank you so much. I hope you'll come back on as the campaign progresses.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come.